I've been able to get most people I've wanted, but this one still hurts. Which just shows you that the exception proves the rule. When I can get someone, I have to leave them before they leave me, because I'm not enough, and I'm about to be found out. But when someone I want doesn't choose me, that just proves I'm not enough, and I've been found out. Heads they win, tails I lose. Either way, to this day, if someone mentions her name, my stomach clenches. The fear that drives me every waking minute had come true. She had even mentioned that drinking was a problem. Just another thing that addiction had cost me. You would think that might knock somebody sober, but it actually made it worse. I lit candles all over my house, drank, watched the movie we were in together, torturing myself, alone, heartsick, trying to get over it, failing. I was bloated and looked awful, and it was dangerous. I remember realizing when I was in ninth grade in Ottawa that Michael J. Fox had both the number one movie and the number one TV show at the same time. And even then, at the age of 14, steam came out of my ears with envy. Later, I told the New York Times, "You want the attention, you want the bucks, and you want the best seat in the restaurant." Fast forward to the hiatus between seasons 5 and 6 of Friends, I found myself filming the whole 9 yards. And sure enough, when it came out in early 2000, I had the number one TV show and the number one movie. Me? I was taking so many pills that I couldn't leave my bedroom. So, in a moment when you'd think Matthew Perry would be celebrating and being the toast of the town, I was just handling drug dealers and living in dark rooms and misery. In nature, when a penguin is injured, the other penguins group around it and prop it up until it's better. This is what my co-stars on Friends did for me. There were times on set when I was extremely hungover, and Jan and Courtney, being devoted to cardio as a cure-all, had a life cycle exercise bike installed backstage. In between rehearsals and takes, I'd head back there and ride that thing like the fires of hell were chasing me. Anything to get my brain power back to normal. I was the injured penguin, but I was determined to not let these wonderful people and this show down. But still, the addiction ravaged me. One time in a scene in a coffee house when I was dressed in a suit, I fell asleep right there on the couch. And disaster was averted only when Matt LeBlanc nudged me awake right before my line. No one noticed, but I knew how close I'd come. But I always showed up, and I always had the lines. And then I got pancreatitis. I was 30 years old. It was during hiatus. I was alone. Again, there was nothing going on, no movies to shoot, nothing. Just slow, tar-like time. Slipping down the LA canyons toward the endless sea. I was just sitting at home for months drinking. Alone so I could drink. Drinking, therefore, alone. As I said, alcoholism is desperate to get you on your own. I was watching the movie Meet Joe Black on repeat, even though it's about the character Death, me, trying to figure out what love is. Perfect. But it was as if I were Joe Black myself, repeatedly asked, "What do we do now?" I was like Death. I'd drink, watch the movie, pass out, wake up, drink, watch the movie, pass out. Then, out of nowhere, I felt a knife slide into my stomach, just like that. It pierced the membrane, twisted a little, its serrated edge catching on the veins, heating my blood to boiling and beyond. As that knife got deeper and deeper, I heard myself screaming in pain, an animal being ripped to shreds up in the canyons. I called my sort of girlfriend at the time, the wonderful Jamie Tarsus, and managed to say, "There's something wrong." Jamie was an angel from God. She drove straight to my house, poured me into her car, and drove me to the nearest hospital. In the ER, I was screaming, "You've got to pump my stomach. You've got to pump my stomach." The doctor just stared at me. I don't need to pump your stomach. It's not food poisoning. Well, then what the fuck is it? I wailed. You have pancreatitis, he said, which is something you can only get from drinking too much. There are a few causes of pancreatitis, actually. You can have an autoimmune disease or an infection or gallstones, but mostly you get it from drinking a fuck ton of alcohol. Pancreatitis at the age of 30 was unheard of. Yay for me. Another record. Fuck that, I said. No, I don't drink too much. It could have been shame. It could have been denial. I think they're hard to tell apart. Whatever it was, I made Jamie drive me home. After about an hour at my house, I knew something still seriously was wrong. So this time we went to a different hospital, but got the same answer. For 30 days and nights, I was in the hospital, fed fluids through an IV. The only way to treat pancreatitis was to leave the pancreas completely alone, which meant I could not eat or drink anything for about 30 days. And for every one of those nights, I'd fall asleep with Jamie Tarsus by my side. She had a bed moved in, the whole bit. So I'd wake up to find her there too. I still believe Jamie was a messenger from a benevolent God, and that none of us were worthy of her. I know I wasn't. We'd watch The West Wing over and over while I smoked. Yes, I smoked in my hospital room. It was a different time, or I was so fucking famous at the time that it didn't matter. At one point, they caught me and told me to stop. But I was desperate, so I checked myself out of the hospital, had a cigarette, and then checked myself back in. It took 7 hours to go through the intake again. It was worth it. To ease the pain, they hooked me up to a machine that administered regular amounts of a drug called Dilaudid. It is an opioid that changes the brain's relationship to pain. If only it came in human form. But I loved Dilaudid. It was my new favorite drug. And I would have stayed in that hospital for 100 days if they kept administering it. For those 30 days, I had Jamie by my side. And I was high and happy, especially happy when I signed the deal for seasons 6 and 7. The deal that, owing to David Schwimmer's selfless and brilliant idea, brought us $50 million. I signed that contract with a feeding tube in my arm and Dilaudid flowing through my brain. But they were on to me, clearly. I was asking for too much of the wonder drug. You're fine, one doctor said. Your pancreatitis is over. You have to go home. Tomorrow. You mean you're not going to give me Dilaudid tonight? No, he said, we are not. Somehow, I got through the night, but nobody knew what to do with me. Enter stage left, my father. Bless him. He offered to have me live with him and his family in Ojai, a town northwest of L.A. Come live with us, he said. Go to some AA meetings. Get yourself straight. It was an okay option, and with nothing else to do, I headed back to my home on Chelan Way, in the Hollywood Hills to pick up some things. I was sober, but I had just been on Dilaudid for 30 days, so I was still a little out of it. Jamie waited while I packed a bag, then I followed her in my green Porsche out along the winding roads of the hills. As I made my first left onto Chelan Drive, there was a courier van right in the middle of the road coming towards me. So I swerved and pumped the brakes, but the car hit some grass and just kept going. I drove into the stairs leading up to a house, demolishing them, then on into the living room. Fortunately, no one was home, but the car was a wreck, and so were the stairs. Fucking stairwells again. I did the right thing and waited for the cops to arrive. I kept glancing up at the sky, wondering when the next cartoon anvil was going to fall on my head. I was there long enough for someone to take a picture and sell it to People magazine. My car in a house, me on the way to staying with my father in Ojai. It was like I was 15 again, living with my dad in California. A car would come pick me up every day to take me to film Friends, but it wasn't too long until I picked up Vicodin again, and then started fucking drinking again, and liking it again. To quote my therapist, reality is an acquired taste, and I had failed to acquire it. I was sneaking both drugs and alcohol into my dad's house, and his wife was so angry that eventually my father calmly approached me and told me that I had to leave. "Oh, I'll leave, but neither of you will ever see a dime of my money, ever," I thought, but did not say. I returned for the next season of Friends high as a kite, and everyone knew that something had to be done. I had already heard about methadone, a drug that promised to remove a 55-a-day Vicodin habit in one day with one little sip. The only catch was you had to drink that little sip every day or you would go into serious withdrawal. "Sounds good to me," my desperate mind thought. I got on the drug immediately and was able to return to Friends the next day, sharp as a tack. I had been told that methadone had no side effects. This was not true. In fact, it was the beginning of the end. Otherwise, everything was going great. Friends was still as successful as ever. And then another cast member came to my trailer. It wasn't David this time, and it wasn't good news. "I know you're drinking," she said. I had long since gotten over her. Ever since she started dating Brad Pitt, I was fine, and it worked out exactly how long to look at her without it being awkward. But still, to be confronted by Jennifer Aniston was devastating, and I was confused. "How can you tell?" I said. "I never worked drunk. I've been trying to hide it." "We can smell it," she said, in a kind of weird but loving way. And the plural "we" hit me like a sledgehammer. "I know I'm drinking too much," I said, "but I don't know exactly what to do about it." Sometimes I wasn't okay to drive to this set. I never worked high, but I certainly worked hungover. And I'd take a limo. That will get you some dubious looks from people, let me tell you. Everyone would ask if I was all right, but nobody wanted to stop the Friends train because it was such a moneymaker. And I just felt horrible about it. My greatest joy was also my biggest nightmare. I was this close to messing up this wonderful thing. Eventually, I got a sober companion at work with me, but it wasn't really helping. One day, I had taken some kind of medication and had drunk the night before, and it all kicked in during a run-through in front of everyone. But there was a curious twist to this one. I was hammered, but I didn't know it. So I thought there was nothing to hide. I didn't know that I was wasted, but I was slurring. Folks couldn't understand a word that came out of my mouth. But I had no idea. Once again, I went back to my dressing room, and everybody from the show was there. "What are you going to do, Maddie?" they said. "It's medication. I'll fix it. I'm sorry." I didn't drink that night. And the next day I showed up to work, but I was on thin ice. I called my manager. "Yeah," he said, "they're on to you." The writers, the cast, fuck everybody, knew, so I said, "You gotta get me a movie, right now, get me out of here." Once again, my idea was to pull a Geographic. I still thought if I removed myself from the situation I was in, I would be able to quit all the drugs and drinking and come out fighting. All I was actually doing was tripling my workload while the drinking and drugs continued to escalate. Because wherever you go, there you are. This also reminded me of the time I'd begged for a pilot and had gotten LAX 2194. Back then, I had enough juice to get a pilot and thereby enough money to drink at the Formosa. Now, as the new century dawned, I had enough juice to be able to score a movie if I wanted it. Serving Sarah would be filmed in Dallas, and I have no idea why I thought that would be the perfect place to get sober. Serving Sarah was a bad movie, but it was made much worse by how bad I was in it. I was in terrible shape, and I was overextended. I was working 4 days a week on the movie, then flying on a private jet back to Los Angeles to do Friends. On the plane, I'd have a water bottle filled with vodka that I'd sip from continually as I read over my lines. In fact, if you're keeping score at home, I was actually on methadone, Xanax, cocaine, and a full quart of vodka a day. One day, in Dallas, I showed up to do a scene only to realize that we'd filmed it a few days earlier. Things were unraveling. Jamie Tarsus, beautiful, amazing, caring, genius Jamie Tarsus, flew out to Texas and was basically my nurse, but I was still drinking and taking all the drugs and trying to hide it from her. One night we were watching TV, and she turned to me and she said, "It looks like you're disappearing." A window opened. The slightest crack, but open. "I don't want to disappear," I whispered. "Stop everything." I called my manager, I called my father, I called everybody. "I'm completely fucked up," I said. "I need help, and I need to go to rehab." Serving Sarah shut down, something that later cost me $650,000. Small price to save my life. Friends postponed my scenes, and off I went to a detox center in Marina del Rey this time, on the west side of L.A. I was a car going 200 miles an hour that just hit a brick wall. A green Porsche hitting a stairwell. Fucking stairwells. The first day they said, "Go to your room, you're not taking any more drugs." But they may as well have said, "Go to your room and just don't breathe anymore." But I have to breathe. No, people have done it before. People have gone in there and stopped breathing. That's exactly what it felt like. I spent 1 month there. One night, during my stay, I was smoking a cigarette and it was raining and there was a light bulb swinging in the smoking section. And I said out loud, "This is what hell is. I'm in hell." It was in Del Rey when I finally picked up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. About 30 pages in, I read, "These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control." I closed the book and began to weep, and I'm weeping now just thinking about it. I was not alone. There was an entire group of people who thought the way I did. And William Silkworth had written this line on July 27, 1938. It was an amazing moment and a terrible moment all at the same time. What this line meant was that I was never going to be alone again. It also meant that I was an alcoholic and would have to stop drinking and drugging right now and every day, one day at a time, for the rest of my life. The folks at Marina Del Rey said, "This guy is hardcore. 30 days is not going to do it for him. He needs long-term treatment." So, from there, they sent me to a Malibu rehab, where I spent the first 12 days not sleeping at all. My liver enzymes were off the charts high. But after about 3 months, I started to get better. I took part in the groups and did the work, as they say. I was living in rehab when Monica and Chandler got married. It was May 17, 2001. 2 months earlier, on March 25, 2001, I'd been detoxing one night when the powers that be decided to give us the night off to watch the Academy Awards. I was lying there, sweating and twitching, filled with fear, barely listening, when Kevin Spacey stepped up to the podium and intoned, "The nominees for Best Performance by an Actress in a Leading Role are Joan Allen in The Contender, Juliette Binoche in Chocolat, Ellen Burstyn in Requiem for a Dream, Laura Linney in You Can Count on Me, and Julia Roberts in Erin Brockovich." Then he said, "And the Oscar goes to Julia Roberts." I watched as Julia kissed her boyfriend at the time, the actor Benjamin Bratt, and walked up the steps to receive her award. Thank you ever so much," she said. "I'm so happy." As she made her speech, a voice rose in that room in the rehab. Urgent, sad, soft, angry, pleading, filled with longing and tears, arguing with the universe while God calmly tapped his cane on the hard, cold world. I made a joke. "I'll take you back," I said. "I'll take you back." The whole room laughed. Though it was not a funny line in a sitcom, this was real life now. These people on the TV were no longer my people. No. The people I was lying in front of, shaking, covered in blankets, were my people now, and I was lucky to have them. They were saving my life. On Julia's big night in Hollywood, I crawled into bed and stared at the ceiling.